From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And for a second day, we are following news of a police shooting of a black man caught on videotape yesterday in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, today in Falcon Heights, Minnesota.
Where Philando Castile, a popular school lunchroom worker, was shot by a police officer during a traffic stop for a broken taillight. His girlfriend, Lavish Reynolds, who thinks he's only suffered an arm wound, begins live streaming directly after describing what happened.
He's licensed to carry. He was trying to get out his ID and his wallet out his pocket, and he let the officer know that he had a firearm and he was reaching for his wallet.
In the video, the officer is still standing outside the car, his gun pointing through the window. Castile is covered in blood.
He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand out.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh, my God, please don't tell me he's dead.
It is very difficult to listen to. Her young daughter, by the way, was also in the car during the stop. St. Paul Pioneer Press reporter Frederick Mello has been covering the story. We reached him by Skype. Frederick, you say this is different from other police shootings. How so?
Well, in so many incidents, the bigger incidents that have gotten a lot of media attention, there's been some kind of scuffle, something that lends at least a little bit of credence or doubt towards the police version of events that, well, I felt threatened, I had to shoot to kill. In this incident, if the girlfriend is to be believed, and she says very clearly, officer, you asked him for his ID, he reached for his ID, and then you shot him dead. He was complying. It was pretty clear that he wasn't in a position to be violent or fighting with the officer. This seems a little more clear-cut than some of the other incidents we've seen around the country.
Well, of course, it'll be investigated, and we haven't heard from the policemen. But in the meantime, how are people reacting there?
Well, there's just an incredible amount of emotion. There were about 200 people outside of the governor's mansion on St. Paul's Summit Avenue last night. And this wasn't just Black Lives Matter or the city's racial advocates. I talked to a Caucasian man, the man named Keenan Bailey, who was a landlord. He couldn't stop crying. This man had touched his son in a very positive way at the elementary school and had been almost like a mentor to his young pre-kindergarten child, Elias. He was terrified of school, terrified of walking through the lunch line alone. For a month, Keenan Bailey would walk his son through the lunch line, and Philando Castillo, as the kitchen supervisor at the J.J. Hill Montessori School, would say, can I get you some fruit? Can I get you some milk? You can do it. And they kind of tag-teamed the son's fears until they went away. He really kind of considered him a member of the family.
This is what the parents of Castile are saying, that he was that kind of a helpful, loving person. She spoke on CNN this morning and said that, like many black parents, she told her son to do one thing when pulled over by police. Let's listen.
Comply. That's the key thing. The key thing in order to try to survive being stopped by the police is to comply. Whatever they ask you to do, do it. Don't say nothing. Just do whatever they want you to do. So what's the difference in complying and you get killed anyway?
Again, the mother of Philando Castile, alluding to the fact that Castile's girlfriend says that he was just complying with the officer's request that he reach in and get a permit or license. But Frederick Mello, that reminds us, the girlfriend who had this either incredible composure or she was in shock and made this, you know, this reportage, streaming it live on Facebook. What are people saying about her?
Well, I think everyone's kind of startled that she had so much wherewithal. She kept calling the officer sir and saying, you just shot him. He tried to comply. She was very kind of direct, polite. The officer kept telling her, keep your hands where I can see him. She's like, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So people are really impressed with her ability to kind of capture the moment. It looks like she understood this is something that often happens to black men. They are stopped. And she wanted to kind of document that.
Frederick, tell us more about what happens now.
Well, it's very interesting. Congresswoman Betty McCollum of Minnesota has actually issued a statement just now asking for the U.S. Department of Justice to pursue a federal investigation. So a lot of people are saying they don't want this to be sent to a civilian panel, a grand jury. They want a non-grand jury indictment.
Is there any sympathy for the officer in the area? He seems as if he's having a breakdown on the tape.
You know, there's a certain sense of just hang back and let the activists and the advocates and the family have their moment. The police press conference last night was all of about a minute. One reporter described it as a 30-word statement.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, are there any questions about guns and officers? You know, what's an officer to do if somebody's licensed to carry? They have to reach for proof of that.
Right. And the idea that he was kind of complying and doing everything that he would be expected to do and was still shot dead is an argument that's going to resonate beyond, I believe, kind of an activist circle or a liberal circle or a racial circle. This is the kind of thing that if you are a card-carrying member of the NRA, you're going, he has a license to carry, he was trying to proffer it, and he was still shot dead. That's not the way it's supposed to work. This is a different kind of case.
Frederick Mello, reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press on the shooting death of Philando Castile. Frederick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow in Warsaw, Poland, the world's most powerful military alliance will have something of a reset. In recent years, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization has been involved in conflicts well beyond Europe's borders in places like Libya and Afghanistan. But with a buildup of defenses against Russia, tomorrow's NATO summit, which President Obama will be attending, marks a return to NATO's Cold War origins. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Cold War history looms over the NATO summit in Warsaw. This is, after all, the same city the Soviet Union once dominated through a rival military alliance called the Warsaw Pact. Earlier this week, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg announced troop reinforcements for four former members of that pact.
We will deploy four robust multinational battalions to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland.
Those four neighbors of Russia had been demanding reinforcements ever since Moscow seized Crimea 2 years ago from Ukraine and helped pro-Russian separatists commandeer eastern Ukraine. Andrius Kubilius is the former prime minister of Lithuania.
What is provoking Russia is weakness of our deterrence capabilities, not initiatives to strengthen deterrence capabilities.
But it's not at all clear yet what the effect will be of sending a 1,000 troop battalion to each of the four Russia-exposed countries. Stephen Pfeiffer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
Even after Warsaw, the actual number of NATO forces that will be in the Baltic states is going to be quite small. But if you ever got into a crisis situation where there was a serious concern that there might be military conflict, one thing that NATO would want to be able to demonstrate or would be able to accomplish would be rapid reinforcement of those forces on the ground in the Baltic states.
Last month in Poland, NATO forces put on an ear-splitting display of their ability to quickly move to remote battlefields.
Currently, attack by fire is conducted by tanks and infantry fighting vehicles.
In the largest military exercise since the Cold War ended, 24 nations took part in a live-fire tank assault in the hills of northern Poland. General Ben Hodges, who commands the U.S. Army in Europe, says the U.S. is moving back tanks and other heavy weapons to the region, and in February, a 5,000-member brigade will be added.
That's a real deterrent force. A U.S. Army armored brigade combat team with all the tanks, the Bradleys, the howitzers, the engineers, that's enough capability to cause a would-be adversary to really reconsider.
And it's no secret that that would-be adversary is Russia. Damon Wilson is a former national security advisor and a NATO expert at the Atlantic Council think tank. He says Russian President Vladimir Putin is unlikely to seek any head-on confrontation with NATO, but
what he will do is probe, test, and look for where there are vulnerabilities, look for our own weaknesses, look for where there is lack of both political will and capability to stop him and exploit that.
Which is why, says Brookings Pfeiffer, the United Kingdom's decision to quit the European Union must be good news for Mr. Putin.
He sees this as a way to increase fissures within Europe. That's been a long-time Russian objective and goes back to Soviet times, the idea of trying to undermine institutions such as NATO, such as the European Union.
Putin is also likely to be pleased by the constant questioning of NATO coming from the Republican Party's presumptive presidential nominee. Here's Donald Trump talking to ABC.
I think NATO is obsolete. NATO was done at a time you had the Soviet Union, which was obviously larger, much larger than Russia is today.
Some of NATO's own members are also getting restless. Again, the Brookings Institution's Stephen Pfeiffer.
One of the really interesting challenges at Warsaw is that you have the eastern flank concern about Russia, but also you have Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, and France saying, but there's also a southern flank. There's ISIS, there's Libya, there's general unrest in that whole broad stretch of the Middle East.
And for those concerns, Pfeiffer says, this NATO summit has far less to offer. There is a vague promise of help in the Mediterranean with refugees and a commitment to funding Afghan troops another 4 years. But this summit is really about NATO going back to what it was created for 67 years ago, holding the line against Moscow. David Wellen, NPR News, Washington.
The Do Not Call registry has been around since 2003. It's supposed to help people limit the number of telemarketing calls that they receive. But being on that Do Not Call list does not stop all the calls, as you may have noticed. And this year, there have been a record number of complaints about robocalls or pre-recorded calls that are often scams, like this one.
This call is officially a final notice from the IRS. The nature and the purpose of this call is to inform you that we have received legal petition notice concerning a tax fraud against you. So before this matter goes to the Federal Claims Courthouse or before you get arrested, please call immediately on our...
There is also this one.
Hello, this is Rachel at Cardholder Services, calling in reference to your current credit card accounts. There are no problems currently with your account. It is urgent that you contact us concerning your eligibility for lowering your interest rate to as little as 6.9%.
So, what's the deal? Tim Marvin of Consumers Union joins us now from San Francisco. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's going well. Thanks for joining us. And why am I getting all these calls? And not just me, but a lot of people are still getting calls even if they're on the Do Not Call list.
Yeah, it's really annoying. And just about every American has signed up for the Do Not Call list. And I think if we did a survey tomorrow, we'd find out that just about every American has probably gotten a robocall in the last week. Here's the deal. In 2003, they passed the Do Not Call list. At the time, that was a great law, and it worked really, really well. People stopped getting phone call solicitations that they didn't want to receive, and people paid attention to the Do Not Call list. But now, since the internet has become so much less expensive to use, people who would like to make a phone call solicitation can make millions of calls for pennies on the dollar simply by having a decent computer set up and a phone number. So before, when people would call, you know, one number at a time and they would kind of cycle through numbers, it would take some time and it would cost a little bit more money. Now, these companies can call thousands and thousands and thousands of phone numbers in a matter of seconds for very little money. So that's really why the Do Not Call list has become ineffective. And the fact is that crooks don't care about the Do Not Call list. If they're trying to scam you out of money, they don't care if you've signed up for the Do Not Call list. And so, you know, the laws just haven't been able to keep up with technology. And that's why we've been calling on major telephone companies to give consumers, their customers, tools to stop blocking these calls before they get to our homes.
But isn't it illegal for these calls to be made in the first place? Why can't the government go after them if what they're doing is illegal?
That's a great question. A lot of them are, especially to your cell phone. But a lot of these calls are generated abroad. So, you know, there might be a call center in Jamaica. You know, they're the ones setting up the, you know, the IRS tax scam. It's not most likely happening in Lawrence, Kansas. It's happening in Jamaica or the Virgin Islands or something like that. And, you know, the fact is that the FTC and the SEC, the regulators who deal with a lot of this, and a lot of attorney generals have gone after legitimate companies who have violated the Telephone Communication Protection Act. But the most egregious of these calls are most likely coming from places that we just can't get to the criminal. And that's why it's important to block these calls before they get to our phones.
Even if on your caller ID or on your phone, it says that the number is coming from within the United States.
Correct. It's really easy for them to fake a number. And now we're seeing them get even you know, more bold. I'm here in the West Coast in San Francisco, and I get numbers all the time with the 415 area code that looks an awful like either my phone number or a phone number that could potentially be a call I think I should take. I pick it up, and it's Rachel from Cardholder Services, you know, tricking me yet again to sign up for something and trying to get my personal information.
And that's the point of these, is they want to get your personal information. They want to get you to send them money or something like that?
Correct. Our conservative estimate is that people lose about $350 million a year in telephone scams. We've seen the numbers much higher, and you know, it's pretty easy. You know, I've had family friends who have gotten the IRS call, the tax scam, and you know, they're just not quite sure. And so it's pretty easy to see someone, a senior, for instance, who might be, you know, not getting a lot of calls or just not quite sure of what they've sent in and what they haven't, going ahead and sending someone they shouldn't money that they probably would be better off having in their bank account.
Before we move on to some of the solutions, and you mentioned that you would like the telephone companies to provide one solution, but before we get there, there are some calls that are still allowed, even with the do not call list, correct?
That's correct. You know, political season's really starting to heat up, and I'm sure that if people had their choice, they would block a lot of the political robocalls that are about to come their way. But political robocalls have an exemption under the Telephone Communication Protection Act. Any company that can show that they've run prior business with you is allowed to robocall you. Same thing with charities and emergency calls. So emergency calls are, you know, I grew up in Buffalo, so we would get one when they closed the roads in the schools.
Right.
So there are some automated calls that are legitimate, even though we do feel that consumers should have the right to block that call if they choose to not receive it. It's the same thing if somebody answers on my door. They have every right to knock on my door, but I also have the right to not go answer the door if I don't want to.
So what about solutions? What could the phone companies do?
Well, we think that the easiest step for them to start making is to offer the consumers free and effective tools to block robocalls. So, you know, some of the solutions that we've seen out there, people might have heard of, the FTC did a competition, and they've had a couple really interesting winners. One of those was a company called Nomo Robo. It allows people to sign up for this service if they have voice over internet protocol. And now they have a cell phone app that you can sign up for. And that allows you to start blocking phone calls. Unfortunately, the phone companies, especially the major phone companies like AT&T, Verizon, and CenturyLink, haven't done much to make that tool accessible and easy to use for their customers. Somebody like Time Warner Cable actually did a really great thing. They allowed their customers to basically one-click opt in to Nomo Robo, and we've heard from consumers that it works really well, that they've seen the number of robocalls drop. You know, it feels good when you're a customer and your company starts listening to you.
And you can just go and download this app if you want to, Nomo Robo, and it'll start working on your cell phone?
Yeah. On your cell phone, there is a cost for that. And if you have an Android cell phone, you have a whole host of apps that you could choose from. And you should really read the reviews and figure out what works best for you. Unfortunately, if you have a traditional copper landline, your options are really limited about what you can do. Basically, you can go out and buy a piece of hardware, set it up at your home, and see if that works for you. You know, we did a review in Consumer Reports magazine about it. And what we found is that, you know, a lot of them do what they say they'll do, but, you know, they're not easy to set up. And again, you're spending money to protect your phone that you're already paying AT&T money to use. And it's just not working the way it should. So what we'd really like to see the phone companies do and start putting technology over their networks that block these calls before they get to our homes. And we really think that that's the solution that companies should be heading towards. And to be honest, they're dragging their feet. They're just not listening to their customers on this.
And in terms of what the customers can do if they continue to receive these calls, should they report them?
Yeah, reporting them to the FTC and the SEC and your attorney general is really helpful. The one place where the phone companies have been helpful is teaming up with a lot of the different applications that are out there, along with regulators, and they meet and they basically say, okay, what are the bad phone numbers that these calls are coming from? And they can start working together to block those numbers. So reporting the numbers is really, really helpful to the regulators and to the phone companies. But at the end of the day, stopping them. You can sign up for Nomo Robo or a service similar like that if you have voice over internet protocol or if you have a cell phone. The best thing to do when you get a call is just not do anything. If you pick up and you can, everyone kind of knows what that click sounds like when it's not a real person. Just hang up. Don't interact. It's really tempting to get frustrated and mess with the phone callers. But to be honest, they're probably just flagging you for more phone calls down the road.
And of course, sometimes companies actually do need to reach their customers and conduct legitimate business. How do you know? Should you just never do any kind of business on the phone like that if somebody's calling you?
You know, there's ways to ask, you know, if I get calls from my bank for the same thing for fraud alerts when I'm traveling. Usually they leave a message and tell me to call back. You know, to be honest, a lot of people with their cell phones have just stopped answering numbers that they don't know. But that is not a practical solution. And that's really, you're getting really to the heart of the problem. We don't know which numbers to trust anymore. And that's why the phone companies need to act. I can't tell the difference between a legitimate call coming from Wells Fargo and an illegitimate call coming from, you know, a cruise line. And so that's why the phone companies need to do more. I can't trust the service that I'm paying for.
If I told you the amount of free cruises that I've won.
I'm surprised you're at work. I thought you'd be on a cruise right now.
Tim Marvin of Consumers Union, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, this week, the Federal Communications Commission ruled that the entire federal government and government contractors are exempt from robocall regulations because the law applies to persons. And according to the FCC, the government doesn't fall under the definition of a person. Congress could pass legislation to change that, but don't count on it. It's members of Congress themselves that end up using a lot of robocalls. You can find more information about call blocking devices and services and how to file complaints about unwanted robocalls at our website, hereandnow.org. And while you're there, let us know if you're getting unwanted telephone solicitations, and if you've tried any of the tools that Tim Marvin suggests for stopping them or any others. It's at hereandnow.org.
Italy is facing a Friday deadline to come up with a plan to reduce bad loans at one of the country's biggest banks. Shares in the Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena, the world's oldest bank, by the way, have lost nearly half their value since the Brexit vote. Other Italian bank shares are also tumbling in what some say could be Europe's next crisis. Time Magazine's Rana Faruhar is in the studio to explain what's going on. She's also author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Hi, Rana.
Hey. Thanks for having me.
So Italy's banks, they were struggling before the Brexit vote. We know the Brexit vote sent the British pound tumbling. We know Britain didn't convert to the euro as countries like Italy did. So what's the connection? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, the Italian situation is really just underscoring this larger European debt crisis that has always been on slow burn, but since Brexit is back in the forefront now. You know, you've seen banking shares fall not just in Italy, but all over Europe. Deutsche Bank, which is the largest German bank and the largest bank, systemically important bank in Europe, is also seeing lows in its shares. And what this says to me is that we may be in for another round of the European debt crisis. Mm. That's not great for Europe, obviously, because it could throw the continent back into recession. It's also not great for the U.S. Europe is our biggest trading partner. You know, we do a lot of business with the continent. So this is a real worry on the global economic radar screen.
And talk a little more about why this is happening. You alluded to it, but it sounds like, tell me if I'm right, you know, people are defaulting on loans. They've got a lot of terrible loans in European banks, especially Italy, which we started talking about. Yeah. And so investors get scared. They think, oh, that bank's not going to do well, so they pull out.
Well, absolutely. And also people start defaulting on their debt if there's an economic slowdown.
Right.
So that's a real risk. You know, a lot of investors just think banks are not going to be in good shape because of that for the next few years. Also, you've got the ECB, just as the Fed has here in the U.S., keeping interest rates very low. That's good for people who, say, want a mortgage and can get one if they're economically solvent. It's not so great for banks because you don't actually then make a lot of money on the money that you're holding. So none of this is good overall for the economy in Europe or the U.S.
Yeah, and the EU also has rules about banking. And so while Italy, the government is considering bailing out the banking system, they have to follow those rules. It could get complicated. But just, I mean, I hate to, you know, this would be bad if Italians are having and Europeans are having this problem. But how does this affect us sitting here in the U.S.? You talked about imports, but what else?
Well, you know, if you think about it, the European continent is about one-third of global growth. I think of the global economy as three legs on a stool. You've got the U.S., You've got the emerging markets led by China, and you've got Europe. Well, if one of those legs is rickety, it puts more pressure on the other two. And as we know, the recovery here in the U.S. is still pretty weak. Janet Yellen, the head of the Fed, has decided to keep rates low for some time now. A lot of people feel that this is creating risk in our own bond markets because people are searching for returns. They're trying to go into riskier areas to make money. And this could end up blowing up in our faces in a few years from now.
You know, we have just a couple seconds, but we also know there's a big move in Italy to do what Britain did and leave the EU.
Exactly.
Will watching what happened in Britain and knowing they have their own economic crisis, will that help that move or not?
I think it creates more populism of the kind that led to Brexit because you get other European countries saying, hey, why should we underwrite the debt of Italy? You know, you already have politicians in France and the Netherlands calling for leave votes. You know, you have possibly a chain of dominoes. So it is a real trigger point moment right now.
What a potential mess. Rana Faruhar, Assisting Managing Editor for Business and Economics at Time Magazine. Thank you so much for coming into the studio to help us with this.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it is time now for a Hawaiian edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Linda Lester Keale hosts Mele Noka Oi on KKCR Community Radio in Kauai, in Hawaii. Linda, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a wonderful day. I'm so delighted to be here.
Well, we are glad to have you here. And you've lived in Hawaii since the 80s. You came from California. What does the name of your show mean, and what kind of music do you play?
The name of my show is Mele Noka Oi, and what it means is the best music. Maui no Kaoi means Maui is the best. Mm. So Mele no Kaoi is like the songs are the best. So every week on my show, I pick the best songs that I can find, the newest recordings, and, you know, kind of my favorites for that week. Most of my show is in Hawaiian language because of the beautiful poetry or haku mele involved in the songs. The songs all tell a story.
So the best music every week, and this must be the best of the best because these are the ones that you picked to bring to us. So let's get to some of the music that you brought. This is the artist Raiatea Helm, and here is Ke Kanihone o na Manu. See, we don't even have to be with you in Kauai to feel like we are with you in Kauai with the music there. But tell us what we're listening to here.
You're listening to her brand new release called Heleo Huale, which means a pure voice. And her style is almost a lost art of female vocalists singing a style called ha'i, where they are able to bring their voice higher and higher and higher and hold those notes, and they're clean and clear and sweet, just like birds. It's an awesome album.
Up next, we have Hoku Zudermeister. This is Ku'upua Sakura. Kaulana ia kounani e ku'upua sakura mai ka aina ho'opukala. He aina haheo kaulana ia kounani he kupua sakura. So what's this song about?
This song is about, was written by Hoku Zudermeister for his mother. And he is comparing the Pua Sakura. Pua is a flower. So the front of the album has these beautiful cherry blossom flowers, which is a symbol of strength and beauty. So he uses in nature the flowers of Pikaki and Sakura to describe his mother and how much he loves her. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. He's, again, one of our top male vocalists here in Hawaii. And it's been 8 years since he released an album. We're really excited about this one, and I feel it's a strong contender for our Hawaiian Grammys next year.
Well, and he's been doing this for a long time. We read on his website that he started dancing hula at a very young age, taught himself ukulele and bass.
Yes. Yeah, he's an awesome, awesome, not only hula dancer, but musician. And everyone I'm talking about, you can also look them up. You can Google about them. You can go on YouTube. They're, you know, very prevalent in the music scene.
If you can figure out how to spell those Hawaiian names that we've been saying. Well, let's get to the next one. This is Chad Takatsugi. This is He Vehi no Pauahi.
Hapuku me hau ola e hokourua i kaua ki oa Hoa pili ia no ka ola uniu Makani hali ala o a palama.
Tell us about this one.
This song is honoring Princess Bernice Bishop, Pauahi Bishop. She was a princess, a Hawaiian princess. She was the last direct descendant of the royal house of Kamehameha. And she left her whole inheritance, which is about one-tenth of Hawaiian lands, to build schools to educate Hawaiian children. So this composition won a very, very powerful award called the Hakumele Award. It's a really beautiful weaving in and out of poetry in the Hawaiian language.
And for people who haven't been to Hawaii or haven't spent much time there, the royal family, King Kamehameha and Queen Kapi'olani from quite a long time ago, more than 100 years ago, they were in power there, still very important to the Hawaiian people today, and it sounds like to Chad Takatsugi as well.
Well, Hawaii was a kingdom.
Right.
And it was recognized in Europe. The Iolani Palace had electricity before the White House. The royal family is still very, very much honored, and the Hawaiian kingdom is still Hawaiian kingdom, even though it's a part of the United States.
Well, we have one more pick from you. This is from a newer artist. This is Ali'i Ke Ana'aina with Eo Ke Kahea O Ke Kahakai. Wow, look at that. Here it is. Sorry, I feel like I need to just order another Mai Tai while we listen to this. Tell me about this one.
Isn't that a great song?
Yeah.
I just love his album. It's called Music and Me, and it tells you a lot about him. It's an there's a lot of energy in this song in particular. It's talking about the ocean. It talks about surfing. It talks about throwing the fishing net and running for the rocks and gathering up the fish. It kind of involves all the things that Hawaiians do, you know, in and around the ocean. The ocean is very nourishing. It feeds us. It cleanses us. It provides entertainment and adventure. And this is a great song.
Well, Linda Lester Keale, host of Mele Noka Oi on KKCR Community Radio in Kauai, you have transported us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. Aloha and ahui ho to everyone.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. We're NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Let's take a look now at politics through a media lens. Donald Trump is defending that tweet he sent out over the weekend. You've probably seen it. Hillary Clinton's face superimposed over a pile of money with a six-pointed star with the text, "Most corrupt candidate ever." Trump and his backers are saying it's just like the star on the ads for the film Frozen. But his critics, including the website Mike, trace it to anti-Semitic white supremacist sites. Dana Schwartz, a writer for the New York Observer, published an essay calling out the Observer's publisher and owner, Jared Kushner, who happens to be Trump's Jewish son-in-law. And yesterday, Kushner responded. So joining us now, NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik with his take on this. David, your thoughts on, first of all, Dana Schwartz's open letter. Both she and Kushner, as we said, are Jewish. She says to not call the meme, that picture, anti-Semitic, would be playing dumb. What else did she say?
Well, she took a lot of issue with the sort of I thought rather weak defenses that various campaign ads for Mr. Trump offered. She said, you know, these were choices made, and she talked about the links that online seeming associations that people affiliated with the Trump mm-hmm. campaign seem to have with certain kinds of folks who express hate and racism. She also asked, Kushner plays a significant role for his father-in-law. He is an advisor to the Trump campaign. And she said, you know, you are an Orthodox Jew. You are observant. You are sincere in these things. How can you allow this to happen? And I think she expressed that very directly. I think it is to the credit of the publication, to the editor, the executive editor of the publication, Ken Kersen, and to you know, to Kushner himself, that note was published, but it was direct, it was forceful, and it was somewhat searing.
And what did Kushner say in response with his own open letter?
He responded in the pages in the website of his own publication. He said, "The Donald Trump I know," and he starts by simply saying, quote, "My father-in-law is not an anti-Semite." And he personally vouches for Trump's faith, for his belief, for his welcoming of not only his faith, but the Ivanka Trump's conversion to Orthodox Judaism and the fact that their children are Jewish as well. He says he's a loving father, father-in-law, and grandfather, which people who know Donald Trump have told me he is. And he says that there's not a hateful bone in his body. He also invoked his own family's history. Jared Kushner is the grandson of Holocaust survivors, and he talked about that, and he offered some details about that, and he said it was a story that he hasn't tended to talk about publicly, but he wanted to do so to indicate that he feels the terms anti-Semitism and racism are tossed about too loosely when his family has borne the brunt of what those sentiments can mean in their most extreme expressions.
And by the way, with this story in mind, we saw Corey Lewandowski, former Trump campaign manager, now correspondent for CNN, in one of his first appearances as a new CNN commentator, he was the first to float this idea that it was a sheriff's badge and not an anti-Semitic badge. So it's interesting that this story is now filtering through media. As is another one, we want to ask you about something you've been tweeting a lot about. Longtime Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson suing Fox News chair Roger Ailes, alleging sexual harassment. More of your thoughts on this.
Well, it's a very explosive charge. Gretchen Carlson was on the air for about 11 years at Fox News, primarily as the female co-host for the morning show Fox and Friends. She said that she had been complaining since 2009 of a sexist atmosphere at that show, on and off the air, particularly from co-host Steve Doocy, a favorite of Ailes and a favorite of Rupert Murdoch, mm-hmm. who's sort of atop that media empire. And that when she complained about it to Ailes directly, he sexually harassed her, that he said, you and I should have had a sexual relationship a long time ago and it would have resolved any problems between the two of them, and that he continued to do so in a number of exchanges. This is, you know, something that Ailes and Murdoch in normal circumstances would just be able to ride out. It's a little surprising that they didn't make any effort to settle this, but there seemed to be indications from her lawyers that, you know, once she was let go late last month, her contract was not renewed, that she decided to take it to court rather than to push the issue internally again.
Now, she says there was a sexist environment, as she said on Fox and Friends. Bloomberg Politics put together a supercut of times when her looks were part of the conversation by male colleagues. Here's a clip.
You know, I was at Liberty last night and some guy came up to me and said, I saw you on Fox and Friends this morning. Is Gretchen as cute in person as she is on TV?
And what did you answer, America?
Gorgeous. Look at her today. Beautiful dress. You look wonderful.
And, you know, there are people who say, well, what's wrong with that, complimenting somebody on how they look? But, of course, it makes her, you know, an object. And as she's sitting there with people who are supposed to be the news people. But your thoughts, did you notice this? And where does this rise for you?
Sure.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, if you watch that full supercut, it was about, I think, a minute and a half long. It is bananas, the extent to which they talk time and again about her looks and, to be honest, the looks of others. There's something of a fraternity house ethos that I think played to Fox News's culturally conservative audience, largely skewing a bit older audience. I've got to say that that is a sensibility that suffuses the network more generally. TV is often based on looks, even TV news, but Fox News particularly so. They have a certain camera called the leg cam, which kind of lingers and ogles along the legs of some of their women personalities deemed more attractive. And I've got to say that, you know, Fox has shown a willingness to pay out to settle such concerns before. Fox News star Bill O'Reilly, Fox paid millions of dollars to settle a sexual harassment suit against him filed by a Fox News producer who caught him on tape. And in fact, a former top Fox News executive was paid off millions because he knew a lot of the secrets and where the bodies were buried. We'll see if this proves to be among them.
We will. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks as always.
You bet.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.